Hello and welcome to CoolBrite, sponsored by Search 5.0. I'm your host, Stephen Turkington, and on today's episode, we're very pleased to welcome JP Horkin, Director of Technology at Aviva. This is a really good conversation where we unpack JP's journey into technology, which included stepping outside his comfort zone at an early age by doing a placement year in Germany. We then discuss industry challenges along with opportunity and the importance of fostering a culture of mentorship, which is something that Aviva take great pride in. I hope you enjoy this conversation. JP, a very warm welcome to CodeBytes.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Really excited to have you on. I think you've got a great story to tell. I know there's some really good initiatives that you're doing within Aviva, which our audience would like to hear as well. As always, I'd love you to kick things off and just give our audience an overview of your experience.
Okay, just to start where I'm at today, I work as a director of technology at Aviva. So that's Aviva, the global leader in industrial software, not the insurance company. And essentially, that's just a fancy title for a work across a number of different software teams, helping them out in terms of their technology direction, practices, and things like that. Bring cohesion across the company where it makes sense. My starting journey, I've always been in computers for a very long time. I studied computers at A level. That got me into programming. From that, I did a degree at Queen's and then progressed my career through a number of different places. I worked in Munich, Dublin, London. Eventually came back to Derry then, to my hometown, to bring up the family. And I suppose through that journey in various different roles, starting off as programmer, progressing to senior programmer, lead software architect, development manager, product manager, and my role as a technologist.
Wow. And now you're firmly a Derry native man for the last number of years. Your exposure.
Still like to do a lot of traveling. I mean, with work with Aviva, like I've been all over the world. Kazakhstan was probably one of the most interesting places I was at, but loads of places in America, all throughout Europe, India, various places like that. There's so much opportunity. If you like traveling, there's so much opportunity. And certainly would be an advocate for anybody just to open up their experiences by doing that, meeting different cultures and all. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And it's something I actually want to touch upon, because you did allude to it in your intro with your experience in Munich. Correct me if I'm wrong, was that a placement year?
So that would have been a placement year, yeah. So yeah, whenever I was doing my degree, it was like a 4-year degree with a 1-year sort of gap year where you go out. And I remember just walking through the halls in Queens, and it was just like a physical board at the stage, just with different printouts of various jobs that might be an offer. And that was the one that intrigued me most. So it was, I just thought, that's a bit cool. I've never been to Germany before. Seems a bit interesting. Never did German as a language or anything, but I just thought, that would be a bit of fun, put myself out in the comfort zone. And there were 6 of us went over, and only 5 of us made it. The other boy is still alive now, but he had enough of it after a few weeks, so he did. He got homesick and came home. That was a really interesting experience, and I think a big lesson there is just put yourself out of your comfort zone. Just really, as I say, like, you never worked abroad before, didn't speak the language, went away with a bunch of strangers, 6 or 5 other fellas that I'd never met before, strange city. So there's just loads to learn. They were just every day, it was like really a school day. And then working Siemens, it was just a massive big company. We would get the train in the morning time, and you would get into this big office, and it was a big underground with all these wee charts that would take you from one part of the building to another. It was like a wee mini city, so it was. So great experiences there. And that was my first real foray into technology, being a programmer, learning what that was about. When going to somewhere like Germany, where I think probably that stereotype view of Germans, very methodical, very diligent, high engineered. They were in the city there of where BMW is, and massive big football stadiums and all that. So it was just like a real wow coming from a place like Derry and even Belfast. Yeah, and at that stage, like, the internet was just really taking off. So it was not really predominantly used, not really, certainly wasn't a mainstream thing, but even in those early days, I got a real interest for it. And I remember reading a book. I remember going to the bookstore and buying a book on JavaScript. I believe it's that many years old. But I think one of the most inspiring things for me at the time is reading the biography of it. I just wanted to learn JavaScript because it was some of the stuff I was working on, and I thought I could do this in this technology. And the guy that wrote it was only 16 years old. And it was like a real Well, it was like a real good book. Like, it was dead easy to follow. I learned loads from it. And that was a real eye-opener to me to go, geez, 16 years old, and this guy's published this book. And back in those days, it just seemed to be such an unattainable thing. And actually, from that then, I remember being on some of the news groups, learning and maybe about JavaScript or something, and seeing somebody posting, go, look, I'm writing this book on internet privacy. Does anybody else want to co-author it? And I thought, aye, why not? And pinged the guy over, and he was based in America or something. He says, yeah, here's the chapters here. Which ones do you want to do? And I said, I'll do those ones. And I think maybe 6 months later, I was a published co-author. So it was, I think, just that putting myself out of that comfort zone, exposing yourself to the sort of new world of the internet and being able to do things that you just couldn't have done before. Certainly my parents would never ever have thought of things like that, but it was just really cool. And the big lesson from that there was just that putting yourself out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, embracing the unknown. Yeah, I love that. And that's what I wanted to speak briefly there on the Munich, because I think if we look at the growing demographic for Codebytes is people in university, GP, which is great, but typically they tend to stay locally, and we spoke with this off air, or else UK. But I think it's just great kind of trying somewhere new in Europe and getting that exposure and embracing the unknown. And obviously it worked out very well with your experience. Probably if we look back now and reflect on your career as a whole, was there a defining moment that you can see resonated with you in your career?
I know we touched on that when we were catching up before, and I think when I thought back about it, that there isn't really one. It's not like a sort of Hollywood movie where there's a real pivot point. It's a downtrodden boy, down in his luck, and then all of a sudden there's this real pivot point that sort of moves on. And I think, like, I've been in now for 20 years and probably at different stages of my journey, it probably was pivotal points. The Munich one was probably the second one that I say just opened up my mind and realized, God, there's so much opportunity here just if you put yourself out there. I think probably the first one, probably most interesting one, is that if I even go back to my final year at school before I went to university, and my dad had a grocery store petrol station, and during that summer break before I was going to Queens, in the back office, the girl ran all the accounts and all the administration. She was going off on maternity leave. So he said to me, I need you to come in. It wasn't really a choice. Like, it was like, I need you to come in. You're going to do all this stuff here. So you shadow Sarah there for a couple of weeks before she went off, and that's what you're going to do. And doing bookkeeping and all that there, I kept making mistakes. It was really tedious. It was one of those things that you came in the morning, you had to come in at 8 o'clock to make sure you got all the sort of change over in the utility. So you're up early in the morning, making loads of mistakes, and you had to stay until all the different things was done. And it used to take me to way over lunchtime, and Sarah would be like mocking me, going, oh, she would get it done maybe in about 3 hours or something like that there, and then would have the rest of the day to herself. And once you get better, you'll get on top of it. And I don't know whether it was my dyslexia at the time in terms of working numbers, or probably more likely I was hungover a lot of the time, causing me to make a lot of mistakes. But I kept thinking, there has to be a better way to do this. And my dad had a computer at the time. He didn't really widely use it, and I remember looking at, I don't know if it was Excel at the time, or that it was the equivalent of Excel, and I think there has to be a better way to do this, and started putting right wee macros, putting all that bookkeeping out of the books into the software. The thing that used to take me certainly probably a good 6 hours, Sarah maybe 3 hours, I automated all that there and put it down into a whole 3 day myself. Then I was thinking that would give me more time to go out and play with my friends, but my dad just gave me extra work to do. But I think probably that the little thing there, the key thing there, was the power of technology. Like at that stage, I'd probably just done my A-level, really loved programming, so I did, and then I was about then to go on to Queens to do the studying around that. And it just really opened my eyes of, geez, technology can really, the job you do today versus the job you do tomorrow using technology is radically transformed. And we can see loads of examples of that, but that was just my wee example. So I think with that sort of seeing what technology could do, the Munich experience in terms of opening the eyes was probably a big thing. And then next, then whenever I went on to my career, I went to Capgemini, big consultancy firm. I think they were the top three in the world at the time, and there was about the cohort of graduates that joined all through Ireland and worked in the Dublin office. I think the year I joined, there was just over 20, maybe 22. The year before that, there was probably about 15. So just IT was really taking off, and there was big growth there. And again, internet wasn't a big thing back in that day. Like, I remember going, like, I was specialized, there was only two of us specialized in internet technologies and did the training around that. So I remember going into my boss, Dave Murphy at the time, going, Dave, I think this is going to take off. We should have more people in this. I don't know, JP, it's probably a bit of a fad, so it is. I think there's probably an aspect there of probably the time and the fortune that I was learning from the Munich experience, learning about JavaScript. And then, and whenever I went into Capgemini, I was in that what was would have been a niche technology set at the time. And I was just really interested in it, and I worked hard, so it did. And from out of that, Capgemini then started to get a few new deals all around internet technologies. And because I was one of the few that had that skill set, worked hard at it, it then gave me a launch pad. I think it was one of the few people then that was promoted to senior within a year or so. So again, it was like a real eye-opener to me to go, that fortune aspect of being in the right technology at the right time, showing a bit of passion and pushing yourself out there in terms of hard work was key. And that gave me a good foundation to kick on. And then probably the other thing that I would recamp on is that if I combine all those wee elements together and think about then the next probably stage in your career, joining a startup company here in Derry, out of the wee broom cupboard in the university, then there was only five of us. And then we went on this just fantastic journey then over 7 odd years, maybe 10 odd years, just growing year on year end, more bigger customers, bigger pressure, expanding our global footprint. And you were just head down. Every day was a school day. Every year was different. Your role was always changed. And I just loved that. I just loved embracing the change and maybe learning to do new things. And there was a point then, I remember one of the staff meetings where our boss, our CEO at the time, Claire, she was presenting something that just really resonated with me. She says, okay, well, this small company based out of Northern Ireland, and yous are developing this software, and she put up this globe of the world. And on the globe of the world, she says, every dot there that you see all throughout the world is the top 10 capital expenditure projects in the world, billions and billions of dollars. So by the budget, here's the top 10. And then she overlaid it there. You see the software you're building there, that you're using 7 of those across the world. And I think there was that sort of intake of breath, because you didn't, as a software engineer, you're focused on the code and things like that, not necessarily the commercial aspect. And probably we had a good night out that night, so we did, because we probably just won whatever was the next one. And I just remember feeling really good of being part of that journey, that working hard, always been curious about technology, and realizing that some small things, a culmination of small things, you can have really a significant impact. Yeah,
I think it's important to see the end goal and the meaning and the purpose that has on the end user. And I love the fact that there was a teenage JP sitting automating accounting procedures before uni, and then getting bombarded with further more work from your dad. We believe, and we're very passionate in mentorship, and keen to learn, what does mentorship mean for you, and how important can one be for one's career?
Yeah, I suppose mentorship, sometimes it's probably confused, or you'd see maybe the role of a manager or a leader or your line management or something. Oh, part of your role is to be a mentor. But I think that sort of blurs what it really means, because in my view, a mentor is really about developing the person. It's really a sort of selfless act. It's probably the way that I would make that delineation, versus if you're working on a team and you have a manager, or you're managing another person. So if you look at it from either angle, there's another facet around that. It's about the performance of that individual that's contributing to that team, that's contributing to the performance of that development. So it becomes less selfless, so it does. Whereas mentorship should really just about being able to, if you're being mentored and you're looking at somebody that can give you just additional insights or perspective from the challenges that you're facing day by day, or if you have a goal, and you don't have a goal, but it's to help you set, well, what does the version of you look like in a year's time? What's the version of you look like in 5 years' time? Well, that seems a long time, but sometimes it helps just to tease out and break down assumptions and make people think about life's precious. In my view, we get one chance of it, so we need to make the best. We both spoke at the start of the call, we both have these Garmin watches, and I'm a big advocate of looking at data, because then that can help you improve and go, look, that run, I was able to cycle that distance, or I was able to cycle at that time, where I'm at now, that really drives you on. You get a lot of satisfaction from that. And I think the same goes in terms of mentorship. looking at where you want to go in your life, in your work, and how you balance those together. So being able to, I would like to think during my time, I've maybe offered that to some other people, but I can certainly attest to there's been a handful of people in my life that have been really strong mentors to me, helped me understand what do you really want, JP, where do you want to go, and picking maybe some of the biases that I had, or help me get out of the rut, or maybe listen to me vent about some complaints, but then maybe turning the spotlight myself, going, what could you do about it, rather than always expecting somebody else is going to solve your problem for you. And I think through that, then it really helps build confidence and motivation that then means that every individual can bring your best self to work so they can. But yeah, that power of mentorship is extremely powerful. And I suppose that's my views of it.
Absolutely. And it's so important to create that environment to have mentors internally, and people can feel safe and just tap you on the shoulder and be that soundboard, JP, as well. And it's good to hear that you've had people in your life and your career who guided you in that journey, because sometimes, in fact, quite often in Code Bites, we have guests that perhaps didn't have a mentor and didn't have that person. So it's their mission to ensure that they're giving back and that they're growing teams to supplement what they perhaps didn't have. So good to hear. And I want to discuss talent. And obviously, listen, you've got several different teams you've led and hired for. What traits would you look for in good talent in today's market?
Okay. I think that the foundational one that we've always recognized, or we've grown over time to recognize, is that the most fundamental one is really having a passion and interest in this area. Some people maybe get into computers or technology because it's there's jobs there, so they are, but they might be okay at it, but they're not really passionate about it. So I think people like that, they can do a job, so they can, but they're not often a key ingredient to a high-performing team. And therefore, if you have people that just are passionate about this, interested in it, it really is the foundational thing to help them, lots of other things. And I suppose whenever you're identifying that, a lot of that can be gained from first impressions, things that maybe are in your CV to go, look, what if for somebody that's maybe starting off and don't have a career in computers or technology, being able to demonstrate that you've done this stuff outside of maybe your university coursework, you've dabbled around, or you have some wee hobby program or some challenges that you've solved. But those start to give wee insights to go, look, this is above, somebody actually is really passionate about this, they are interested in that. And then I think sometimes once you start having a conversation with somebody, that maybe that first introductory call, again, you can tell from their enthusiasm or their anecdotes to go, have you just done a course and they've just hit the boxes and their natural skills and abilities have meant they've passed, versus have they actually went out of their way to learn about it, or do they start to form opinions about they would use this technology over that technology, we like this over that. Those are really good indicators to start to tell you if somebody has that foundational aspect. I think the next important thing is probably something that annoys me whenever I go and I talk to schools or maybe young people who are thinking about this as a career, and you hear what's maybe disseminated down is you go, oh, you have to be good at maths. Unless you're in the advanced maths class or you're doing A-level maths, then you can't do this. And indeed, we'll talk there about beforehand, I was hearing about my son, he's away off to do an apprenticeship with Deloitte now. And whenever he applied to go into the A-level, the teachers were saying, we don't know, you haven't done this before, and you don't have an advanced maths, so we don't know if you can do the technology subjects. And we had to talk to the school and convince him. And I said, look, while I'm this background, I'll be there to support him. And it seemed to be reluctantly that they let him into the world. And lo and behold, he got the top marks in his degree, his A-level. And I think the message there, as long as you're good at solving problems, there is a mathematical element of it, but it's not purely mathematical. If you have a logical mindset, if you like things in order, breaking things down, trying to understand the cause of things and have that curiosity, you can do that without really strong maths skills. There's other ways to understand whether somebody has that problem-solving aptitude, certainly above and beyond whether they top marks in maths. It is a foundational aspect, and I suppose I'm a bit passionate about it, probably from my own experiences, is that I think sometimes that's confused problem-solving aptitude and your ability to fit into technology. I think we don't always measure that adequately or assess people fairly around that. And then the third ingredient then I would say about that is the communication and teamwork. We build software that is used by humans and people, and also it's never built in isolation. You're always working within the team. You're always collaborating with others. No one single person knows all the answers. You always need support. That ability to be able to communicate and work with others is key. Now, that is something that can be learned and developed, and certainly that's where my mind has probably changed and developed over years, understanding that certain people in their early stages of career, people that have high tendencies for problem solving sometimes, and I don't want to generalize here, but sometimes in occasion where people have that high strength, they may not necessarily have a high strength then in being able to collaborate or communicate with people. And I think what I've learned over time is that rather than dismissing that to go, it's that person, they're a bit of the weird person. It's like, no, they just think a different way. And I think if you understand that and embrace that diversity, it can be a huge benefit to the team and also help that person as well develop where they need to be able to support and work with others as well. So I think those elements is about the identifying the good talent. And then in terms of retaining that, I think really it's probably as a leader, yeah, somebody that's more advanced roles, it's about setting them up for success and then probably getting out of their way, which is not something I would have done in my early stages of leadership, where it was like, because you got into that leadership role as somebody that was really passionate, hands-on, you did the work, you felt as if in leading people, you had to be sitting beside them, showing them how to do something. But the reality that in this industry, it's highly talented, highly educated professionals, and therefore it's about telling them what they need to do, providing them with that purpose to go, look, if you do this, it has this effect in the bigger picture, and then giving them autonomy then to figure out how to solve that problem. They may not solve it in the way that you previously did, but you know what, they may actually come up with a far better way of doing that. So allowing them that autonomy to do that, and then supporting them build up their mastery. And so be it technical training or, again, allowing them the environment, the opportunity, the work that you give them, that they're building up layer after layer. You're allowing them to make mistakes, and therefore that's encouraging that risk, that sort of fail-fast approach. And then from that, you know, best learning comes from that. So we can all read books, watch blogs, whatever. But I think in this world, there certainly from my experience, there's no better way to learn than yourself making mistakes, stop and reflect and going, I'll not do that again, I'll try this out differently. So allowing that mastery to foster. And then finally, just having fun. Any of the great teams that I've worked with, we've always just had a bit of crack. We pushed each other hard, we critically examined the decisions we've made or how we went about things. But what allows you to do that and foster high performance is then if you have downtime, you go and chill, let's just sit and have lunch together. Or on Aviva, we do these Action for Good events where the team goes out and they went to Foyle Hospice there and help them do good clean up their grounds, and we're doing a walk to hike up Errigal. And you come across different, you end up then interacting with different people in the team, you get maybe a different appreciation for why they are the way they are, and helps you open up your mind for the value that they can bring to the team. And I think that's usually the special ingredients in my end.
There's huge significance in that about bringing people external outside of their working environment. You get to know them at a different level, and I think they feel free and able to do. And I did actually see the work you did with Foyle Hospice on LinkedIn, which looked pretty good. I'll not comment on the photo, which I think you were lying down with your feet with the other two people working. We'll not go there. But I think you're totally right. I think you have to embrace diversity. And I think when you get people in, be it introverts or extroverts or whatever combination, it's allowing them to feel safe, playing to their strengths. And then, wow, that's where innovation, absolutely. You mentioned the fail forward. That's the whole combination, which just makes a beautiful end product. So I enjoy that. I want to move on to the current industry that we're in. Obviously, there's lots of noise and there's lots of major topics that we hear, see and feel on a daily basis. From your experience, what's the main challenge that you feel we're currently experiencing as an industry?
An ongoing challenge is always talent access. And I think in light of the global pandemic there, working from home all of a sudden becomes, this is an accepted thing, whereas before it was more of an exception. So therefore, any company now, you're not only in competition with others that are in your geographical region, but actually you're now in competition with companies all throughout the world. So it turned things in its head in terms of how you proposition yourself as a company to go, why come and work for us versus work somewhere else. So I think that's an ongoing one, and there's probably, we're still finding our feet with that from the global pandemic in terms of how companies best proposition themselves. That'll be, it's always an ongoing one, but there's something that was a sort of notable event in time that's added a new dimension to that. The other dimension to that then is establishing a good norm for hybrid working. It's great having the flexibility of being able to work from home, but there are certain situations that there's just really no substitute for getting around, being face-to-face and really collaborating in that more face-to-face way, as companies are trying to figure out what that looks like. And you'll often see news topics about such and such a company is bringing everybody back, or they're increasing their mandated days of work. I don't think anybody really knows. I think different companies are maybe skewing versus studies and analysis of, we think this is best, but I think we're still learning really what that looks like. And then the other thing then is AI adoption. Really this year, I was at Microsoft's conference there over in Seattle a few months back, and it was just AI in your face in a really good way, just in terms of the things that you could do as a developer or the way you could solve customers' problems. It was just profound. So it was just awesome. But the other side of that is that, say, from developers now, there's AI tools that you can embed in your environment, in your Visual Studio environment or whatever, that help you write code. You can write, this is the problem we want to solve, and then all of a sudden, all the code's generated for you. But the big legal challenge there is, where's that code come from? Was that learning model picked that code up from somebody else's open source that you need to attribute licenses to? And so there's a big word, and there's a couple of lawsuits at the minute that I believe are still ongoing. It's trying to figure that out. So we are at the cusp of being able to leverage certainly a boost in productivity and innovation, but there's the legal system is trying to catch up around that and holding us back to a degree. So I think those would be the main ones in terms of those industry challenges right now.
I think today we're in a different place. I think certainly from a talent point of view, whenever AI started, I know AI has been about for a while, but I think what we felt was particularly in around March, April, May time, there was perhaps software engineers and developers that are quite fearful perhaps of AI and what does that mean for them and security and job. But now we're definitely shifted in the mindset where it's there to elevate us and to enhance us as well. And interesting as well about the talent market, which you alluded to, because you're right, as a whole, we're in a different market compared to 3 years ago or even 4 years ago. There's more competition for businesses who are looking to grow and looking to scale. I think especially last year, what we found was there was a whole influx of mainland GB companies that were hiring remote and snapped up quite a lot of our talent. Now, I can see that sort of shifting. I think people who have worked remotely for a year to a year and a half, I think they're needing and craving that human interaction. So I think definitely talent's a lot more receptive into hybrid working. And it's not just about going in for the sake of it, it's going in for purpose. It's whiteboard sessions, getting ideas down, having that full collaboration. It's something very special. JP, I'm going to put it on yourselves with Aviva, because obviously you're a growing company, you've got a huge amount of people, and you want to be in a position where you're attracting talent. What sort of initiatives would you be doing within Aviva to make you as an employer of choice, if you like, in a more competitive market?
Yeah, I think Aviva certainly embraced that hybrid, flexible way of working. Certainly it's very people-orientated in terms of understanding the nuances of everybody's individual life. And it's about then being able to go look at that individual, look at the team they're in, and try and figure out the best way to enable as much flexibility to them as possible, which I think is great. So it is. And what that really encourages, and what Aviva has high targets on, is focus on in terms of its goals, is preparing its workforce, in terms of its leadership and at all facets of its hiring and retention focuses, that retention or a diverse workforce is key to innovation. So there's lots of sort of various initiatives within Aviva around that. In terms then of some of the other topics we talked about, we've just launched this year a new mentorship program where we have new consolidator or IT systems, and and through that consolidation, there's a new mechanism now through the back office system that you use that helps you put yourself out there to the wider Aviva community to go, I want to be your mentor, or I want to be a mentor, and here's a wee bit of a profile about me. And it allows that sort of social connections of people who want to be mentors with others, and so really fostering again and promoting that idea. Lots of technology advancements. I think anybody that wants to work in technology wants to be solving complicated problems, and an industrial engineer, and there's no end of complicated problems to solve. And certainly I think that's one of the key elements that Aviva would pitch itself as. In okay, it's maybe not always consumer oriented software, as in you may use it in your day-to-day life, but the software that we build changes it's a global software. It's used by all sorts of companies. I think historically it's traditionally associated with oil and gas, maybe those things that aren't really associated with sustainability, but it's going beyond that now in terms of wind farms, renewable energies, and then day-to-day things that we use, like dog food factories or beverage factories and things like that. And it's all about trying to see how can we make these, and that's where there's lots of opportunity that the companies look at in terms of leveraging AI to start to think about how can we, you know, make an impact in the world in terms of the carbon footprint and that. So that's going on. Other things, we have this Action for Good, where every employee is given, keeps going up every year. I can't remember now, is it 3 days or maybe even more, where you just have an opportunity to either do something individually yourself or do things as a group. And one example there was a guy in the office, there was a local charity, had a cybersecurity incident that they had, and they were just at the whim then of all these companies going, okay, we can make a lot of money off you, but we'll offer you a service and you have to buy this X, Y, and Z. And the guy here in the office, so the charity reached out to myself and I put them in contact with the guy here that sort of knows about that. And he's able to devote one of his Action for Good days to go in and help with them and help them assess it. There's all these companies trying to sell us things. What do we really need versus what are they trying to oversell us? So saving the charity, you know, lots of money. So there's one wee example versus in the other things where people do beach cleanups and cycles and all manner of things. I really love that. I think it's good that the company's doing more and more of that. And even recently, they started introducing summer days that they recognize summer's a bit of a downtime. We're trying to spend time with family, so they boosted people's holidays with extra just discretionary days. So I think that's the thing that I really like about Aviva, is that they're trying to be always in the forefront of thinking about the people, recognizing the people as their strongest asset. You know, the customers buy our software, and it's, you know, there's a lot of money that they put into the software, but what sits behind that's the people. And I can see lots of initiative, everything that I've talked about, purpose, autonomy, mastery, a lot of our practices are being constantly critically examined to make sure that's the case. And there's lots of great people as well trying to think of all the other aspects of diversity and well-being, all that good stuff.
And I think it's great, and it's evident even from the outside looking in at just how community driven Aviva are, which is just, I think it's just a brilliant value to have. And I love, by the way, the mentorship program that's going to kick off internally. And I was spoke a bit more detail about that previously, but even just hearing the buy-in that you've had from staff members, and I think that's just going to be a great initiative and a great environment, and it's great to hear, more importantly. AP, what advice would you have to any aspiring technologist in today's market?
I think there's the foundational stuff in terms of your problem-solving skills, being curious and learning to communicate. I think that's just a given, so it is. There's nothing special there, but I think that probably two, if it was a tip, two pieces, I know you're always asking me one, and I elaborate beyond this. Probably understand the why. I think if it was to think about anything, is think about why you're doing something. So that could be you're following a particular process, you're in a team, and this is the way we do things. And one of the things that I would have always said to the team, it was like a real anti-pattern. If somebody was ever asked why they're doing something, and they turned around and said, JP told me, or it rippled up, it was like, no, that's, you just fundamentally got that all wrong. So you have to be able to question and buy into and understand why you're doing something. If you're writing that particular style of code, or you're following a particular code and architectural pattern, again, why are you doing that? And because that curiosity to ask that question, not only will it either A, heighten your knowledge, your understanding, which helps you make sure that you're not making any more bugs, but B, you know what, you by you questioning that, you may challenge, actually, it was, that was fine for this problem, but it isn't fine for this. And we need to change the way we write this code to make it more maintainable and performant, and so on and so forth. But I think number one, the probably most important question is to ask our customers why and think about the job they want to do. More often than not, whenever I've engaged with customers, it's, I want you to put a red button up there or add this thing into this form. And there is lots of companies you would say, well, customer's king, the customer's always right, but they're not when it comes to the way that they communicate the problem to you. Because I think humans are inherently nature, we're problem-solving animals, and therefore whenever a customer communicates with you, it tends to be loaded with their interpretation of the problem or the solution. So it could be using like a jobs to be done methodology where you don't care about the solution. The way, say, we share our photographs today with one another is radically different to the way we did it 5 years ago. The job to be done is still the same. You want to maintain your precious memories and share that with others, but it's not that we now have a bigger, faster camera. No, we use mobile phones now, so it's a totally different thing that's solving the problem that we used to have. And that only comes about, that innovation only comes about by poking and prodding to go, what's the job, what's the problem you're trying to solve? And I, as the expert in technology, can best help you come up with a solution around that. Understand the why is, I think, if you stick to that one thing, it'll help you in so many different aspects. And then probably one final thing is, don't be afraid to take risks, because that's where the learning comes. And if you find yourself in an environment where that discourages that, then you should probably leave. There's so much choice in terms of companies, and I've always been fortunate enough to work with leaders, companies that say, look, we want to take risks. Do now ask for forgiveness later. It's maybe if you're working in a more sort of life critical environment, maybe there's less tolerance for risks, but it's probably trying to always understand where's that tolerance for risks and pushing those down, if I put anybody's lives at risk or anything like that there, but just looking for those opportunities to push the boundaries.
Be curious, embrace your curiosity, and take risks. Brilliant. JP, this has been a brilliant conversation. To wrap things up, I want to learn if there's been a particular book or audio that's had a profound impact for you and your career, and why would that be?
Again, I have four, but I'll rattle through them quite quickly. The Architecture Patterns is the Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture by Martin Fowler. I think if you're a technologist, you should always be trying to think about how do you make nice, clean, easy to maintain code. So if you think about that, learning about architectural patterns is absolutely key. Thinking about the people side of things in terms of collaboration, working with teams, if you find yourself butting up heads against people, if you read or watch video blogs or anything about Radical Candor by Kim Scott, then I think that you'll learn a lot from that. Certainly opened up my eyes. I think one, it's not a book, it was actually a blog that I read, or maybe a paper in Harvard, and it was titled How I Learned My Workers to Lead by Ralph Steyer. She was the owner of Johnsonville Sausage Factory, and it was all about him. He was highly successful in terms of managing this company, highly profitable, leading sausage factory in America, but it lacked real significant growth, and he was worried about competitors. And I think the most fundamental thing that irked him was that people didn't seem to care, as in his workforce. They went and they came, they turned up to work, and you didn't make any mistakes or anything like that there, but they weren't really passionate about it. And he was thinking, it's my sausages, it's my factory. And he started thinking about that and trying to improve it. And what he realized is that he had total control, he had total ownership from tasting everything to making decisions about people's salaries and all sorts of things, that he really owned all of that because he started a small company and felt he needed to own all of that. And it just built a lot of apathy within his staff, and he started trying things out in terms of, probably the first one is to start to trust the people around him, that there was others around him that could help make the decisions, can help lead. And therefore he started with just setting goals, starting to communicate to his workforce to set goals and start to take that thing to step back. And then being supportive, encouraging, and open to feedback. And I think for me, as I transitioned from an individual contributor to a leader, I think that was like I'd made loads of mistakes. So it had really loads of frustrations. And I think that was something that was like a real aha moment for me, just reading this. I think it's maybe heard about it in a TED talk or something like that there, but I read it and every once in a while I could go back and read it again, because it just was really just a real choice reminder of leadership is not about being that expert in everything. It's just about empowering others and allowing others and trusting the people around you. So for me, that was quite inspirational. I think something you always would refer to.
You know what? I'm going to plug those in the show notes as well, because there might have been somebody who's currently in a situation where they're the sole contributor, moving up perhaps to more of a principal role or a lead role, perhaps, that are facing the same challenges that you might have faced now. So we'll be able to share that content of knowledge. JP, this again, this has been an absolute brilliant, embracing conversation. Lots of great things going on for Aviva. Before we sign off, what's the future hold for yourself and Aviva?
For myself, probably continued personal growth, given some anecdotes in terms of achievements, milestones, and in the new role I'm in now, the company has, I've probably come into this relatively new role at around the time the company's been through more significant change in terms of lots of mergers of different software companies and teams. I suppose for me, it's just trying to figure out how can I make that wider impact within Aviva, start to move the needle. So that's my focus. And in terms of Aviva, it's, as I say, like we used to be very much, I think 50 years ago, focused around 3D designing, orientated towards oil and gas. Now it's much more bigger. It's everything about the design, the simulation, operation, maintaining of all these industrial assets, and how do we do that in a sustainable way. That's a mission and goal, is to be the leader at that and transform the industry in that regard.
JP, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Hello, and thank you for checking out this episode with JP. I think you'll agree, it was a great episode. A lot of good take-homes. I especially love how they foster the community spirit within Aviva. Tune in for further great guests in the next coming weeks. And as always, we really appreciate your participation.